大家好啊，我是张震。这期又录天书了，但是其实就是我一个人聊一聊，因为最近要请我一个朋友来我这儿开一个课，讲那个古代印度的。然后我是昨天跟他录了个节目，录了个直播，让他讲了讲这个课，讲了讲他要讲什么。当然，我们这个课是用英语讲的，昨天也学了好多，就给大家传达一下精神。然后先说一下我们这个课啊，这个课是这周日开始，7月7号开始，每周日上午9到11点北京时间，一共连续8周，8月25号结课，每次呢是 Kelly Smith，就是我这朋友授课人，他讲1个半小时，也许会多一点，然后给大家30分钟讨论的时间，或者他可能要拖堂就给他拖堂的时间，中间会休息10分钟，然后我们用 Zoom 上课，每次都有录像，可以回放也可以下载。然后是全英文的授课，因为他是美国人嘛，不会讲中文。价格是2880一个人，然后老学员减100，两个人同时报名各减100，在校的学生老师减100，可以叠加这些优惠。然后你上了第一次之后，你觉得不合适，听不懂或者觉得没意思，你可以退课，都可以免费，就可以全额退款。然后这个课有一个大善人啊，提供了5个免费的名额。所以你如果是在校学生，你可以申请这个免费的名额来听课，但是你要写一段话，就说你为什么要学这个课。如果我觉得你写的不错，写的情深意切，我就会给你这免费名额，基本上就是先到先得。然后我就来讲一下这个课，这个课叫古代印度 （Ancient India），就先讲讲这两个词儿，什么叫 Ancient，什么叫 India。这个 India 就是中文印度。其实是一个从希腊语进入英语的词儿。这希腊语这个词儿是来自波斯语，Hindu。这 Hindu 是来自印度河，但是印度河以前叫 Sindhu，就是今天巴基斯坦信德省，就是这个河名，然后来称呼整个印度这南亚四大陆吧。那南亚四大陆现在包括印度、巴基斯坦、孟加拉、尼泊尔、不丹，还有岛国就是斯里兰卡、马尔代夫。基本上今天说印度就都包括这些东西，这些地方大概就是这么个地理范围。但是什么叫古代？就是这个课是从印度河文明一直讲到吉多王朝开始之前。吉多王朝是印度古代一个非常兴盛的王朝了，它时间大概是兴盛的时候是319到467，但是它出现的时候可能更早。但是也没有一个特别严格的一个时间线，因为它也是从小变大的。就为什么把这个课的结束点放在吉多王朝开始之前，其实是需要聊一聊的。就是吉多王朝算是印度古典时期的开端。所谓印度古典时期的开端的特征，就是开始用这个古典梵文，来做跨地区交际的语言。就是我之前就以为梵文就是古代印度一直在通行的语言，所有人都说，但实际上不是这样啊。以前就只有少部分可能宗教人士在说，后来扩展到跨地区交际的时候是已经比较晚了。比如说阿育王时代，公元前200多年，他在各地立的那个石碑都不是用梵文写的，只有到了比较后来的公元后了，才开始用古典梵文来立石碑。然后，这个吉多王朝还出现了伽利陀娑，就这个伽利达萨，他是印度古代长诗的一个集大成者吧。然后，他就奠定了印度整个文明、整个文学之后的基调。所以，这个也是一个非常大的变化。所以，就以这个为结束点，就是看这个吉多王朝之前的印度的历史。一共分8讲，然后我们昨天就稍微讲了讲这每讲都要讲什么，然后我就稍微说一说。第一讲是讲印度河文明，印度河文明其实就不是今天的印度人，至少他们说的语言不是今天的印度人的语言的前身，甚至我们不太清楚他们当时说的什么语言。印度河不在印度，印度河在今天巴基斯坦，然后。人们在这儿，在这个巴基斯坦境内发现了一些特别古老的城市，叫什么摩亨焦达罗，还有哈拉帕，有时候就叫哈拉帕文明。然后那城市里面有排水系统啊， 就城市的出现是非常重要的一个文明的标志。城市的意思就是，大家可以聚在一起生活，不用去种地，就是这个农业比较发展，然后少，就不用100%的人都去种地，有一部分人种地就能够支持一部分人不种地，他们就可以聚在一起生活，宗教啊、文学啊、艺术啊、手工业啊，干别的。这个时代非常早，公元前2500年可能就有了，但是后来这个文明就衰落了，然后也不知道为什么就没有了，这城市就没有了。而且呢，就我觉得它好像跟后来的关系也不大。就问 Kelly 为什么要学这个文明，为什么要以这儿开始？这好像跟后面都不连着。然后 Kelly 就说，不连着你也得学了之后才能说它不连着。但是连不连着，其实也不是光看这个语言连不连着。其实，一个文明、一个文化，它重要的，并不只是文本，它没有语言文本留下来，但是它其实留下来了很多其他的生产生活的技术，比如说，怎么耕种啊，怎么这个冶炼啊之类的，所以也是很大程度上影响到了后面。所以就是要看看这个印度河文明到底咋回事儿。然后第二讲就是这个犁居吠陀时代，就是今天的印度人是讲这个一种，就是各，当然现在印度讲的语言都不一样了。北印度主要的语言都是一种叫印度语系吧，而这个印度语系的各个方言、各个语言都可以上溯到梵文的再往前就是吠陀梵文，就是这帮人都是从那个草原过来的。我现在在那个圣彼得堡啊，因为来俄国就想看看这个草原的遗址，所以去了阿尔泰共和国的巴泽雷克遗址，这儿就出了好多当年的那个墓地。但是这巴泽雷克遗址的时代相对来说还是比较晚，公元前5到3世纪，就春秋战国那会儿吧。但实际上在草原上还有更早时代的墓葬，都是一个土包一个土包的，叫库尔干。就这种土包墓葬，就认为是古代印度伊朗人的祖先。就印度伊朗人，他本来是在中亚大草原，在比如说南俄，在西伯利亚，在那一大片活动的。后来因为什么原因也不知道，就往南移动，然后一部分就去了伊朗，一部分就跨过了新都库什山，就在今天阿富汗境内，就进入了印度。然后这些印度伊朗人对自己的称呼，就是这些人他们是说同样语言的，然后享有共同的文化。这个语言就是今天的印度各种语言、伊朗的各种语言的祖先，所以我们就把这种语言叫做印度伊朗语。当然，他们没有文字啊，我们也没有任何关于这些人所谓的印度伊朗语的材料。这个他们说的啥话，我们都是通过后世的这些文献反推出来的，是一种构拟的语言。就是说，这个印度伊朗语的人，他们就是还带着他们自己的这个信仰和文化，他们是游牧民族，就是都赶着那个牛车生活。说那个全村的家当，可能一家就一个车，然后全村的家当就是一串车，然后他们走到哪儿就把这车围一圈，就在这车中间就是他们的村了，然后想走就可以走。所以他们是游牧民族，然后他们信仰的宗教，就是古代人那个宗教跟现在想象的宗教不太一样，不是说基督教、佛教或者伊斯兰教，还有经典，还有那个经，还有教主什么的，他们就是传统宗教，就是相当于像希腊罗马一样，就是信神呗，这神那神，然后他们也信各种神，这些神其实跟其他古代印度人、希腊、罗马、北欧什么的都有点关系，都是共同祖先嘛，都来自古代印度人。他们信这些神，就要做这个仪式，赞颂这些神。做仪式的时候，就会创作一些赞歌，就是歌颂这些神。这些赞歌后来被收集起来了，编成了就是一个合集，这就叫吠陀，最早的就叫犁居吠陀。然后第二讲就是要讲这些赞歌被创作的时代，他们的这个社会到底是什么样子。就是想要从这些宗教性的诗歌当中去窥探当时的社会形态。这个宗教诗歌一共有 1018首还是28首，反正1000几十首。但是想这个语言也非常难，它不光语法现象特别复杂，而且它这个因为是诗歌嘛，而且对神的赞歌有各种语言游戏，各种故意说的不清不楚的话，所以想要全都明白非常难，而要想要从这里面再去窥探它背后的反映的社会就更难了。但是最近有一些新的发现和新的认识，就是说这个吠陀时代，离居吠陀时代，就是他们这个最早的时代，大概是公元前1500年，他慢慢进入这个印度次大陆，就到了巴基斯坦那一块儿啊。就这个离居吠陀时代的人的社会，它是有一种季节性。这种季节性就是说，在夏天的时候，这个大家都散到各处去放牧，去那游牧。然后等到冬天的时候，冷的时候，大家又集合在一个过冬点儿一块儿过日子。所以它在冬天的时候的政治形态和在夏天的时候政治形态是完全不一样。就相当于比如说夏天的时候没有国家，冬天的时候就有国家；冬天的时候就有国王，夏天的时候就没国王，是一种时聚时散的一种政治形态。这个就跟就是就大家好像没听说过，没听说过哪现在哪个国家是这样的。但是 Kelly 举了一个例子，就好像学生上学一样，春秋的时候上学，冬夏的时候放假，其实他那个状态也不太一样。不过现在中国太卷了，这个春夏秋冬都天天上学，那假期比那个平常还累。不过这是题外话了，就这种季节性的政治变化，其实在其他的社会当中也能够看见，在美洲的原住民当中，有些人也是这样的。而且他们就如果你了解了这种季节性的政治变化，就是很多事情就迎刃而解了。就很多那个诗歌里面讲的事儿，你才能明白到底在说什么。所以要这也算是非常前沿的这个学术观点了。所以要从这个角度来看一看，最早的离居吠陀时代到底印度的社会是什么样？离居吠陀之后呢，就是这个圣歌就被编纂成合集，而且被人们背诵下来，然后人们就不再从创作新的诗歌。就是离居吠陀时代是说这些诗歌被创作的年代，它之后的时代就是这个圣歌就要定型了，定型之后就不再创作新的了，大家就背这些圣歌，然后再创作别的。这就叫三吠陀时代，就一共有四个吠陀嘛，就是一共四部。离居吠陀是最早的，叫 Rig Veda，之后叫什么雅珠卢吠陀、叶柔吠陀、梭摩吠陀、萨摩吠陀，还有阿塔瓦吠陀。这啥意思？我也说不上来。雅珠卢是祭祀，萨摩是唱歌。反正就在这个时代，他们就这个社会发生了一些变化，比如说，这个整个宗教体系啊，这个宗教和政治的关系啊。然后这个仪式的传承啊，都有一些变化，所以就想看看这个时代。这是第三讲，然后第四讲呢，就讲这个恒河平原的城市化，这也是一个非常有趣的话题，而且我之前也没有这么想过。就是说，在公元前6世纪左右吧，在这个恒河平原，就是印度北部，特别是靠东边，就今天可能是比哈尔邦之类的。就是北部东边这一大片恒河中下游地区，出现了很多很多的小的城邦，就是有城市、城市国家，就是城市为中心，周围农村作为支持。古代就中国对这个的说法叫什么"十六国"时期，就是说有16个小国，当然也不止十六个，就出现了一堆这种城市国家。所以就是说，他们这些印度人，这些说，雅利安语的，就是印度伊朗语，当然是吠陀梵文的这些人，他们本来是游牧生活的人，对吧？他们弄一大车，车转一圈就一村了。那他们是怎么就变成了有城市呢？而且这城市是在东边兴起的，就为什么会出现这个城市？城市兴起之后，对整个这个印度历史又发生了什么样的影响？我们就要看这个。然后有了城市之后，再下一步就是第五讲，就要讲那个早期的佛教和其他教。就是佛教兴起的时候，大概是公元前五世纪、六世纪的样子， 公元前五世纪吧，就因为现在佛陀到底是什么时候人也没有一个确定的说法，然后佛教说的那些都那个不可信，因为他们那个就随便说嘛，他们说啥时候都有。但是佛教也不是从石头缝里蹦出来的，佛教是当时的一大批寺少当中的一种，就是叫什么，叫厌世或叫避世类的宗教，叫 renunciation， 就是要从正常的生产生活中当中退出来，不在外企上班了，不在那个国企上班了，要辞职啊，不再卷了啊，受不了了，我进入森林生活，追求解脱，追求那个身心灵啊，大概就这么个意思。但是不光佛教要这样，很多很多这个就是出现了一大批思潮，就各种各样的人都干这个，然后就都提出了自己不同的理论，然后就是想把佛教置于这种这个叫什么厌世避世风潮的这个思想风潮当中来看待。另外一点呢，就是要考察这个佛教的传说，比如说佛陀故事，什么净饭王的儿子，然后从小就那个上好学校，上人大附，然后呢上北大，上哈佛，就是然后娶妻生子，去什么投行，就是都给安排好了一大堆那个富荣华富的生活等着呢，结果他这个卷不动了，就非常痛苦，然后就得抑郁症，然后就要去修行，就要身心灵去，然后还什么出城看见生老病死，看人间皆苦，反正就是大家都耳熟能详的那些佛教故事。但是这些佛教故事它最完整的这个版本是马明，是一个公元二世纪公元一百多年的一个人，他写的一个长诗叫做那个佛所行赞。其实他这个诗他离那个佛陀的时代已经非常久了，至少有五百年了，所以他写这个佛陀行赞里面讲的佛陀故事，然后从那个犍陀罗艺术当中看到的那些佛陀故事，就到底有多少是有历史成分的，到底有多少是虚构的，对吧？然后要怎么判断哪些是真实的，哪些是虚构的，然后怎么在一个文本当中去判断它的分层，哪些部分是更古老的传承下来的东西，哪些部分是就是作者这个发挥创造的，这个其实是需要我们思考的。耆那教也类似，耆那教是跟佛教差不多同时的一个印度的本土宗教，到现在也在印度还活着，然后有好多寺庙啊，然后有一堆书啊什么的，然后他们的那个不太一样，他们的出家人都不穿衣服，就有两派，一派是完全不穿衣服的叫天衣派，一派是穿一件衣服叫白衣派，然后他们也跟佛教一样，就是不许有任何个人财产，耆那教是不许有任何个人财产，佛教是只能有非常有限的，有数的，比如几件衣服、一个碗这种，就是也是这种厌世思潮吧。就这种厌世思潮是怎么来的？是谁分？是肯定是有一个土壤啊发明出来的，对吧？这个到底是怎么回事？所以就是因为中国人，我们了解佛教，一般都是只了解佛教，就是而且是完全按照佛教的那些说法去了解佛教，而且是作为就把佛教作为一个印度唯一的宗教来了解佛教，而并不知道印度当时有很多很多不同的思想流派，然后就是相互竞争，佛教只是这个其中的一派，然后就还觉得那个佛教说特对，佛教说特好。但你要是看当时跟佛教竞争的那些其他教派说的跟佛教完全不相反，但是你看他们说你也会觉得他们说的特对，就跟那看辩论赛似的，你看正方说你觉得说真对啊，然后反方一说你也觉得这说的也真对，所以你都不知道到底应该怎么回事，所以咱不能光听正方说法，也得听听反方说法，不过佛教可能更像是反方的。然后在中国的那个对佛教描述当中，一般认为说佛教是对那个 婆罗门教，所谓婆罗门教的那个反抗，说婆罗门教有那个四种性嘛，然后是劳动人民反抗压迫的一种形式。然后 Kelly 说，这个其实在西方也有类似的说法，就说那个佛教是反对权威，就有点像那马丁路德反抗天主教一样，所以很多情况下都是对这个提出理论的人的当时的这个世界的一种反应。好，这个应该会是非常精彩的一讲，因为 Kelly 现在他的这个就是职位就是研究耆那教的，所以他以前是研究那个吠陀的嘛，但是他拿到了这个耆那教的职位，所以他也要做一做耆那教的研究。然后第六讲呢，就讲亚历山大，这个我们直播的时候就没时间讲了，但 Kelly 也在他这个教学大纲当中提了一下，就说亚历山大来之前，这印度没有国王，印度都是开会，大家民主制，大家集体决定。亚历山大来了之后，就才发现哦，原来是可以有国王这种东西，可以有这个统治天下的国王，就是统一全天下的这种。就这种政治概念、政治理念，给整个印度带来了极大的冲击，所以才催生了后面的政治制度。然后这个就产生了一个新的概念，叫转轮王。就转轮王就说要统治世界啊什么的。然后后来还有那个孔雀王朝啊、阿育王啊什么的。就这个西方来的亚历山大来的入侵，对印度的影响非常大。但是呢，这个影响在后世被打扮成印度本土的思想。比如说这个转轮王，没有人，至少我是没见过有谁说这是亚历山大来了才有的。但是其实就 Kelly 说，这个是受亚历山大影响才出现的。然后比如说阿育王，他在全印度各地都立了石柱，或者在大石头上刻字，这个也是受到波斯的影响。就是在石头上刻字这个事儿，之前在印度也没有。比如秦始皇不是也满处走，然后留下刻字吗？泰山石刻什么的，狼牙石刻，其实这个应该也跟波斯的影响有关系，因为中国之前也不在山上刻字，顶多有那个石鼓文，在一个石头上，小个的石头上刻一刻。然后孔雀王朝那个石柱，阿育王的石柱顶上是两个背对背的狮子，就这种以动物来装饰柱子，这也是波斯，就是波斯波利斯就那样嘛。波斯波利斯是两个牛，也有两个狮子的，但是人家那个柱子上面还顶梁呢。这阿育王这个就直接就一个单背一个柱子，也是一种退化吧，瓦房电话。然后第七讲是讲这个史诗的时代啊，就是这个摩诃婆罗多和罗摩衍那的时代，就是。这个就是印度文学这个进一步的发展了。然后第八讲就讲这个前古典时代，就是在这个基多王朝出现之前，就在这个时候也有一些新的人，就是什么什么印度帕提亚人、印度塞人都进入印度了。然后他们来了之后，给印度的社会带来一些新的变化、新的影响。而且在这个时代也出现了这种梵文的叫法论，也是为之后梵文成为跨地区交际的语言有一个先声吧。这个时代还出现了这个大乘佛教的经典，以及一些那个就陀罗尼，就是佛教经咒啊。这也佛教经咒之后就是那个不是藏传，就是密宗佛教的开端。所以这个时代也比较有意思，但是他就没有仔细讲这第七讲、第八讲讲什么，所以我也不知道啊，所以得听听才行。应该会非常非常精彩，就是大家如果感兴趣，而且如果可以那个听英语的话，就可以来上这个课。但是现在这个用 Zoom 上课，它都有那个实时的叫什么字幕，其实非常好用，就能够极大的帮助听懂他在说什么。然后他提到了什么古代的地名啊、人名啊、书名啊、作品名啊什么的，他都会写 PPT 上，所以也没啥难的，不用担心自己不会，就反正面向的都是这零基础的普通大众啊，所以你只要英语行，就普通的说话能听懂就可以来上，好吧。然后之后我会把我跟他这个直播的 录音放上来，大家就听一听啊，感受一下啊。好，那就听录音吧。
So I'm Zhang Zhan, and I'm the host of this course, and I invited my friend Kelly Smith to offer a course on ancient India this summer. A few years ago, Kelly came to my platform and gave several courses on Sanskrit, which was pretty successful, I would say. And some students from his Sanskrit course have developed a deep interest in not only in Sanskrit, but also in the linguistics of PIE. But that shows that Kelly is a very capable teacher and he's very fun. Before we talk about the course, actually, Kelly, would you like to talk about yourself a little bit so that people can know who you are, where you work, and etc.?
Yeah, thanks, Zizi. So I'm currently in Georgia. I'm an assistant professor of religious studies at Georgia College and State University. Previously, I was a college fellow at Harvard University, but I didn't love the commute. That was an airplane every week. So now I only drive 1 hour, which is a great improvement. My background is that I got a bachelor's degree in 2007 in linguistics, a master's degree in historical linguistics in 2010, and then I switched to religious studies and historical studies out of just language studies and got a PhD in South Asian studies from Harvard University in 2017. I actually entered that program. It was originally the Department of Sanskrit and Indian Studies, and then they changed it at the last minute. And I tried to get a PhD that still said Sanskrit and Indian Studies, but they were resistant. I said, what about just like an honorary MA in Sanskrit and Indian Studies to represent the years I was in that department?
So what's on your diploma?
What's on my diploma is South Asian Studies. In Latin, of course, it says like the studies of like submeridianus, Asia submeridianus. You know,
yeah,
it's all like made up modern Latin. The University of Harvardardianum.
And even Cambridge is in a strange Latin word, like Cantabri something.
Cantabrigia. So mainly my initial research was that I studied on the poetic tradition. I was interested in, you know, both Zizi and I had the same master in Iranian studies, Okhtar Shervo, and Okhtar Shervo's ideas about Zarathustra as a performer figure rather than a historical entity, I found deeply enchanting. And I brought that over to looking at the Vedas and looking at the key figures in the Vedas, the gods and the seers as performed characters. That was my initial work. Although now I sort of do more broadly religious studies, but also economic studies of the, I guess I would say anthropology of religion and anthropology of economics in early South Asia from the Vedic period up until the classical period. Technically, for instance, I'm the Jain studies chair at GCSU. So I'm also cranking out Jainism scholarship in addition to being primarily specialized in the Vedas.
Nice.
Yeah.
I don't even know what language that Jains used in the ancient times.
Well, they used, in a sense, nobody knows because the Jain corpus was lost. That's something we'll talk about on, let me make sure I know which, that's something we'll talk about on session number 5, early Buddhism and Jainism.
Yeah.
See, whereas early Buddhism, you know, there's a great debate as to what language did the Buddha speak, but it probably wasn't too many centuries before Pali and became one of the primary scriptural languages for encoding the lessons or the suttas of the Buddha. But in the case of Jainism, we don't really have a shared corpus at all. And both major Jain divisions, the Shvetambaras and the Digambaras, believe that most of what Mahavira, the founder of Jainism, originally taught has been lost. So it's interesting in that if you say, what is the original language of Jainism? Well, according to the Digambaras, Mahavira didn't teach in a language. He just emanated a kind of vibration. And then his chief Ganadharas, his chief students, each interpreted it into their own language.
Let's stop here. I
All
don't
right.
I know you can talk about the Jains forever. Let's talk about the course from the very beginning. Okay, so this is called
Okay.
Ancient India. So I want to unpack this title. Would you talk about what is India and what is ancient India and this time frame and why you chose this time frame as
Well, I
ancient
think
India?
ancient will be more easy to explain than
Is
India,
it? I
right?
think India is easier, no?
You think India is easier?
I don't know. It can be
Well, of course, India is
complicated.
the name of a modern nation, right? That prior to it being a modern nation was simply a term, a designation that that really applied to a whole swath of different kingdoms and regions and Janapadas, a form of ancient republic, so that word again. So when I say India, we're actually going to be talking about areas that are outside of the state of India as well. But India is sort of easier to wrap your brain around. So when I say India, I don't mean the bounds of the modern state of India. We could call it Greater India. South Asia might be too big because South Asia includes things like Tibet and Nepal and Burma. But really, our story actually begins in probably what would be the session one when we look at the Indus Valley civilization, the earliest architectural and archaeological evidence of human habitation in what I'm calling India is a lot of it's in Pakistan. And in fact, it's much easier legally to do excavations in Pakistan than it is in India. So we could call that Greater India. India is not a great name, actually, for reasons we'll find out when we get to why the Greeks called this place India. But that's not until lesson
Four.
number six.
Okay.
Yeah. Because India is indeed a Greek version of a Persian word, which is the Persian version of a Sanskrit word. So that's, I think, the much more complicated problem. When we say ancient is simply, let's begin with our earliest signs of human habitation in archaeological records.
I think it's easy to start from Indus Valley civilization. I can understand
Yeah.
that. That's about
The question is, when do you stop?
Where do you cut off?
Well, that actually isn't all that complicated either. Precise, just because we're going to bump into another major era. So this is everything before that era that is called the classical period of India. And there's some debate as to when the classical period begins, but really it's usually synonymous with the Gupta Empire, which begins in the 4th century CE. Although it could be argued that it begins a little earlier with the proliferation of certain types of courtly texts. It's not clear under whose empire that might have happened, or if it's really a courtly or imperial phenomenon. But some people have pushed the beginning of the classical period back to the 2nd century CE. Nevertheless, when I say ancient India, I actually am doing something much easier than I think what you imagine I'm doing, because I'm not strictly defining the Vedic period, the Indus Valley civilization. I'm not limiting myself to the Ashokan period, or what is generally called the Between the Empires period after the fall of Ashoka Maurya's empire, but before the rise of the Guptas. I'm basically saying this is, I could have titled this The History of Pre-Classical India.
But why is Gupta different? What are the features making them classical?
I mean, what is the justification with Guptas being classical? Well, I think usually it's defined, and the other word Well, the other place we see the adjective classical floating around is when we talk about classical Sanskrit. So it's really under the Guptas that the particular classical form of Paninian Sanskrit proliferates all over and becomes the translocal language, not just of inscriptions and of course, of religious ceremony, but classical Sanskrit becomes the language of all sorts of everyday things, like manuals on how to design a house, manuals on how to give someone a haircut, manuals on how to cut gems, all sorts of documents. It becomes a sort of standard translocal language reflecting the aspiration of the Guptas to not rule one place, but to rule all places. So the major challenge to that, of course, is that Sanskrit, classical Sanskrit, does have a life before the Guptas, of course. Although it's a little harder to see because there isn't as good of a documentary inscriptional record. We don't have all these inscriptions saying, like, hey, it's me, Samudragupta. I'm the king of kings and all that business. But classical Sanskrit does wend its way out of India through translations into China. Through what? Through Buddhist texts. So there's a little bit of that's part of the debate. Do we want to say that classical Sanskrit in the classical period is synonymous with the rise of the Guptas and their political project? Or do we want to say that classical Sanskrit, or that the Guptas are essentially picking up on an idea that Buddhists already had?
But it seems to me that the idea of classical India or the classical period signifies that there's a break. There's a fundamental break from the previous periods. No? Or it's just
I mean, I
but
think there are a series of fundamental breaks throughout South Asian history. I'm not sure if I would say that the break happens between what we call the classical period and what we call whatever is before that, the ancient period. I mean, I see where you're coming from because we would expect, but this isn't sort of a dynastic model, right? Which we would use in many other civilizations. Where we can say, oh, this is, when we talk about the break between the late Bronze Age and the early Iron Age in Mesopotamia, we're not really talking about iron and bronze, right? We're talking about the collapse of Mitanni, of the Hittites, the Babylonians, and the Egyptians that seemed to all have happened pretty close to one another. Technically, there was iron in that area, and it was used, it was just not really very important. But we've decided to say this is when the late Bronze Age ended, and this is when the early Iron Age began because of these other things. So there's a clear political and cultural break that lets us say these are two different major periods of civilization. For my money, when it comes to ancient India, there are breaks that occur. For instance, the invasion of Alexander is a tremendous break. We could have taught a course that was pre-Alexandrian India and then post-Alexandrian India, I suppose. There are these moments of punctuated equilibrium where it seems like things could have gone in any direction and then they sort of committed to one and the outcome is history. But I'm not entirely certain if the rise of the Guptas is that moment, to be honest. I think that's why it's so hard to pin down exactly when. The classical period starts because the Guptas are not the first one to make a good, beautiful Kavya inscription. It's Rudradaman the Saka in the 2nd century CE.
It's
So maybe we want to move the classical period back to him.
it's our people.
Yeah. But on the other hand, the flourishing of courtly Sanskrit might have died out if it was just Rudradaman and Buddhaghosa, but in with the rise of the Guptas, we see the rise of a figure of the court poet Kalidasa. And Kalidasa, in terms of literary culture, really is a defining of the era. He's the one that people look back, and ironically, he doesn't have many of the, well, I get into it at some future point, but I think part of the reason that people give the Gupta Empire, as opposed to later empires or earlier empires, so much weight is because that's when Kalidasa began his oeuvre, and it had tremendous influences on the literary development of the classical period. Well, see, it's tautological, the literary development of the remaining millennium. And, now we can talk about modern academic departments. History, this period of history isn't studied in history departments in Europe and in the United States, at least. The history departments don't touch this sort of thing. So maybe the kind of analytical eye they would bring, that they bring to other eras of history, they would maybe organize things very differently. But who studies this period of time, if not people in history departments? It's people in religious studies departments, and people in comparative literature departments, and people in area studies departments. And they are very, very committed to literature as the mark of culture. For weal or for woe, they're into poetry, they're into novels and narratives, they're into that far more than thinking about a s history as defined by a series of battles, the way that we see. I mean, this of course is just a this is not how I'm not I don't mean to malign historians and say that they're just interested in a series of battles. I know they aren't. But what I do mean is, I think that the people that are studying ancient India have a bias. They have a bias for literature rather than literary history rather than and religious history rather than political history. And that has helped define the classical period, because it's a period of literary fluid,
I see.
maybe rather than a tremendous political break, at least in my understanding. I'm sure that there are dozens of scholars that would completely disagree with what I just said. But that, I think, is part of, in my mind, a justification for studying the pre-Gupta period as on its own terms, as opposed to the post-Gupta period, where people are adopting. I mean, this is also the period when we see Buddhists and Jains too adopting classical Sanskrit as a mode of writing, so that they can all debate in a kind of lingua franca, rather than a regional one, a translocal one, so that you could be a philosopher on the east coast of India and read the argumentation and debate of someone like Vasubandhu all the way over in the west coast of India, or in Afghanistan. You could read something that someone wrote in Takshala, or you could read the Mula Majjhamika Karikas of Nagarjuna, who might have been South Asian. That is, he might have been maybe in the Malabar coast. So now there's this, and you could see how that would appeal to people like me, who are interested in the history of ideas more than the history of material culture, that this is a sharp break, a period where it's possible to have international dialogue through Sanskrit.
I see. I think that there's an important point about the role of Sanskrit as a trans-regional language during this period. But in my previous impression, I thought Sanskrit had always been the trans-regional language, which is apparently not the case. So Sanskrit, it is relatively late that Sanskrit became this lingua franca in India, and India was woven into a whole by this common cultural traits, I think, and that's why we call Gupta as the beginning of the classical period, right?
That's right. Although, the Guptas might not ultimately be responsible for it. They might have just jumped onto a good idea. Who's ultimately responsible is sometimes projected back to Rudradaman, the Sakya, but sometimes also Buddhists, because Buddhists had a vested interest in making texts that were accessible all over the place. So, of course, a lot of people know that one of the holy languages of Buddhism is Pali. But that seemed to have been a phenomenon that at this time was m largely relegated to a certain region, the South, that it was an international region, but or an international language, but maybe not as broad as Sanskrit aspired to be. After all, Buddhaghosa, the great commentator on the Pali Canon, is in Sri Lanka, right? And So sort of out of the major action of the Silk Road, if you will. Another major important Buddhist language is Gandharan. But Gandharan is the language that was spoken in Gandhara, which is the Afghanistan region. It's likely that that language spread a little bit through parts of the Tarim Basin on and maybe is related to Nia, another Prakrit that Buddhists were writing in, but it just doesn't have the kind of universal power that Sanskrit evidently could develop, since not only was this a language that with the right educational tools anyone could master, and therefore was had tons and tons of pedagogical materials on how to learn Sanskrit. I mean, that is what Panini does in the 4th century BC. His oeuvre is not, hey, Sanskrit is great. It's here, this is how you learn Sanskrit. So it's a language that had a long history of being able to be to train people in Sanskrit. And the other advantage is, of course, that the other advantage is specifically that it doesn't belong to a specific region, and therefore it takes out of the equation any kind of regional competition, right? To spread Gandharan throughout India and Central Asia as the Buddhist language would kind of privilege Gandhara. What is Sanskrit the language? What region is Sanskrit the language of? Nowhere. And so it's, in a sense, it's equitable in that sense, right? You're not privileging Magadhan in the east. That's what many Ashokan inscriptions are in. You're not privileging a Western dialect like Saraseni or Maharashtri, which evidently must have been extremely important in its time. But what Sanskrit is the language of everyone because it's a language of nowhere, in a sense.
It sounds like
And that must
English.
have been very useful.
Yeah, great. So I think we talk about the end, and we can jump back to the beginning. And we will start this course from the Indus Valley civilization. Actually, I visited Pakistan a few months ago, maybe even less than 2 months ago. I went into Pakistan from the north, from Kara along the Karakoram Highway, and all the way to Peshawar along the Indus for a large part of it. I guess basically Pakistan nowadays is just a big valley, big Indus Valley. But as far as I know about the Indus Valley civilization, it's that it vanished for some reason unknown. So why do we need to study Indus Valley civilization in order to understand India? Because it seems inconsequential for me.
Well, I think part of the reason we want to study this, I mean, there's a number of reasons, but let me answer the question, if it were inconsequential, why would we want to study it? And then what if it weren't inconsequential? Why would we want to study it? So let's imagine that it is inconsequential. To me, that's a case of you don't know what you don't know, right? There's no, let's imagine that there's no evidence that it is of consequence to later India. But that doesn't mean that it isn't. It's just that we don't have evidence of that. So hypothetically, if we were to imagine that this civilization is of no consequence, then we would want to study it for thoroughness and exhaustiveness. You don't want to produce a theory of the past that has, in which you've ignored a tremendous amount of data. You still need to know the materials to conclusively decide that it's of no consequence, if that makes sense. It would be like beginning your, what would be a good comparison? There's a lot of evidence that early phases of the city of Uruk, there was a sharp cultural break prior to there being kings, in which you might say, well, this temple complex seems to be of no consequence to the later dynastic kingship systems. Similarly, you could say, well, there's not a lot of evidence that the core dynastic model of the ancient Shang survived in the Zhou, right? But then you would be, if you'd made that hasty decision, you would be precluding yourself from the possibility of ever discovering something of consequence. For instance, like the earliest form of writing in China, or the prehistory of writing in Uruk, which it turns out is very interesting because before writing, they would, if they were trading something, they would have to put little objects and seal it in a ball of clay. And then the person who received it would open it up and there'd be small little objects, and then they would know how many orders. So that if an order was stolen and it didn't match up to the hidden little objects that had been sealed in clay, right? So we could say this is a sharp break because there's no writing in this early phase of Uruk, but that's likely the origin of the cylinder seal, the idea that there's something that could seal something hermetically so that to vouchsafe for its contents. So one is, even if you think it's inconsequential, you must know the materials to maintain that idea. Two, I don't think it's inconsequential because I don't think it's inconsequential because ultimately this is, must be a source for a lot of, first of all, it's a source for the entirety of, up to a point, the entirety of Indian, early Indian agriculture, right? Like our early sources, Vedic peoples, they know Swidening, but they don't really know anything else. Swidening, by the way, is slash and burn farming. You burn something down, and then they knew how to plant various things like barley and gather them before moving on to another pasture land. But they clearly weren't fixed field farmers. But Indus Valley civilization, they understood the different monsoons. They had three large crop cycles. They knew how to grow sorghum. They knew how to grow millet. This was before rice had spread into India. But nevertheless, it just depends on what you think culture is. A lot of people, and I think in religious studies and literary studies, we're guilty of seeing culture as synonymous with literature, philosophy, and religious ideas. But culture is also just the way you do things. Culture is also just the way the if you decide to wear your tie your hair in a certain way as opposed to another way, if you decide to that you're going to wear this kind of wool or this kind of linen or this kind of cotton garb, right? That is technology is culture in that sense. And a vast amount of Indian culture was its horticultural or its agricultural practices. And just because the civilization of the Indus Valley seems to have vanished without leaving a textual record that we know of, that we can understand, that would be that looked like the the incipit, the source of later philosophical and religious ideas in India. They've left a tremendous inheritance in things that people have generally overlooked and thought less important. That is the core notions of how to produce food and how to build stepwells and how to organize villages, things like that. These are the very things that we don't see evidence at all of in Vedic texts. For instance, in Vedic texts, if you there's no real, I mean, the way you establish a village is you take your caravan and you go around in a big circle, and the caravan is the outer wall, and then you kind of hang out in the middle of it, and that's your temporary campsite, right? That's not a village. That's certainly not a fortified village. Where did, in some ways, we could also say that, I mean, there's a vast amount of early technology that we can't necessarily conclusively, I think, say comes from the Indus Valley, but it came from somewhere. And the Vedic texts aren't enough to accommodate all that. So it's still important. In the same ways that, by the way, I probably only mentioned this in passing during the first session, but there's a huge megalithic culture in South India, right? In the mountains, in the mountain ranges in modern day Tamil Nadu. Those probably aren't related to Indus Valley at all. And what do they leave behind? No clue, except these megaliths, these enormous stones. It's still important to have an inventory of these things. Should things change, should our understanding of the past changes, you want to know about these things so that you can integrate them into whatever new theory seems the least implausible at the time. You don't get anywhere by simply ignoring it and pretending it didn't happen, because in a way, it's just as interesting. It would be just as interesting if it was deeply influential. It's also just as interesting when things are not influential? What happened there? What was the social organization such that people avoided recreating the Indus Valley, right? I don't think those people died or just went poof in a puff of smoke. I don't think aliens came and kidnapped them. I think more likely there was a conscious decision now to avoid large urban cultures. And those were decisions made by people who had options, presumably, and picked what they thought was best for themselves. And it was not large urban cultures. And that's interesting too. So I think it's an important place to start, even though we know the least about this particular civilization.
Nice. And then we in the next session we come to the Rig Vedic era. So you this is what you mainly study. So what are you going to bring in this session?
Whoa, this is my specialty, right? So it'll be very difficult to restrain myself. But what I hope to do is do something that we don't usually see. You can pick up lots of books on the Rig Veda, and there's lots of people that will tell you what the Vedas were about. But usually there's a privileged place for the idea of the polytheism, the gods, the ritual. And of course, it's important to mention the religious ideas of the Vedic period. But what I hope to do is show a little bit more of what kind of a political history we can reconstruct from this period. It's not, it's, it gives a limited vision to only approach by assuming that whatever we're looking at must represent some sort of interior religious spiritual sentiments. What other kinds of things? Why did people engage in these rituals? Why did people do them? How did they interact with the rest of society? What was society? What did society look like? So my hope is to give something of a political history too of the Rig Vedic period, inferred indirectly through admittedly texts that are primarily about this religious ceremony and festival. But I mean, I think that most of us who've been to some sort of quasi-religious ceremony or festival know that it's not just about interior feelings of religiosity. Whether it's a memorial honoring people that died, or a revolution, or whatever it is, people get together, they eat, they give speeches about the past and about their values. Through those moments of public performance, we can infer a lot about the values of a civilization, not just their religious values, but their political values. And that's what I hope to bring to this expanding view of the Rig Veda that I don't think students will find elsewhere.
I think
So, yeah.
we need to back up a little bit. So the next phase of the course will talk about the Aryans coming into the subcontinent. The so-called Aryans are a group of Indians, sans not Sanskrit, but Indo-Iranian speaking herdsmen, and they brought with them some hymns, some religious rituals, which came down to us as the Rig Veda. And
Yes, but
yeah, please.
you go ahead.
But now we read this text just as religious texts. We
Right.
try to understand the society through these texts, which are very scanty compared to the society, of course. But I think it's very, at least it's a good attempt to reconstruct the endural political structure of the society, which I heard that you said that it can be seasonal in some terms. So,
Yes, those are ideas that weren't mine. They actually date back over half a century to Indological scholars like Kuiper and Schleyrath and Hans Peter Schmidt. All of these figures saw a fundamental seasonality to Vedic existence. And that's something that's important to talk about because we can be blinded to that seasonality because very few in a modern capitalist society focused around constant industry. Very few of us, apart from our brief vacations, actually live in a way where where we shift our lifestyles seasonally in major ways. We simply modify our lifestyles for the seasons. When it's summertime, you don't quit your job and start a new summer job. You just turn up the air conditioning a little. When it's wintertime, you don't move to some warmer place. You just turn on the heat. And certainly with refrigeration and international shipping, we don't change our diets based off of what's growing at this particular time. We can grow anything we want anywhere. So the degree to which things are seasonal is muted in our own lives, except for one, I mean, except for a few types of jobs, like for instance, Christmas tree salesman, I'm sure, is a very seasonal job, but also students. Students typically have a season of study and then an off season. And that, at least in the United States, for instance, that happened because people were desperate to get young children into some kind of school so that they would learn to read and write. But their parents were very resistant because they wanted children primarily as farm labor. And so an agreement was made essentially that in the off season, where farm labor was not intensive, children would go to school and learn to read and write. And then when farming labor picked up, they would return to their parents and work full time in the fields. So that's a kind of seasonal existence that persists in our modern academic semester system. Lots of places have begun to go away from that too and turn school into a full year thing. In the United States, at least, that's happening bit by bit. So it's easy to erode the seasonality of things and then lose sight of these nuances and dimensions in the texts themselves. So, yes, our Rig Veda day will be about Indo-Iranian as a language family, its relationship to Iranian, but also in situ reconstruction of what are the values of this early period. And here I would say there is a sharp break between what we can call the Rig Vedic period or the Sukta period, the period when the texts of the Rig Veda were composed, and what comes next, which gets its own day. The triple Vedic period, when the suktas were collected into an anthology of hymns, which we now call the Rig Veda, but also there was a creation of a Yajurveda and a Samaveda. Likely the suktas of the Atharva Veda were composed more or less at this time. And there's a radical break with not just the organization of religious labor and religious oral texts which are being transmitted, but likely the application of those texts seem to be very different in some contexts. And what's interesting is it looks like myths that we see in the Triple Vedic period from prose texts like the Brahmanas seem to describe exactly that happening. A discussion of, well, once a, well, I won't get into it now, but it does seem to be a huge social organizational break, which is suggestive of a political organizational break. And that's why those 2 days are different days.
And in the fourth session, the title is the urbanization of the Gangetic plain. And it seems that the Indian society came into a new form of social structure. And what's that social structure, and what was its influence of later periods?
Well, it's quite debated exactly how this all rolls out. If you follow God, and we'll go into this, but if you follow scholars like Johannes Bronckhorst, essentially, instead of seeing a logical development of Vedic period of pastoral, non-urban civilization to a sudden rise of urban civilization, he would rather you see it as regional, that is, in the Western regions. In places like the modern Punjab and Haryana and Western Uttar Pradesh, that the Vedic society, without its cities and its large architectural projects, persisted for some time. And while in the East, it was in the East that a completely different culture, still Indo-Aryan, but not Vedic, begins to arise. And that Vedic ideas and religion had not penetrated into this region, so we shouldn't presume them. And it's in this area, in Magadha and in eastern Uttar Pradesh, that you see the rise of cities in the Siktish 6-ish century BCE, and also the rise of ascetic traditions like Buddhism and Jainism. So in this session, we get to weigh those ideas. I think that Johannes Bronckhorst makes a lot of good points, but I don't agree with all of them. And so we want to evaluate what's going on there. Why did urban civilization suddenly arise? What was its value? And what were its consequent conceptual and political changes such that we see them already completely reflected in even the earliest Buddhist and Jain texts, where there's a dis where there are distinct things like merchant communities and urban living and in things like inherited monarchy, which you don't really see in Vedic texts. So there are lots of differences, and you could say that this definitely, whether the urbanization itself represents the major break, or if there was already a break in culture that was regional, is hard to say. But it certainly is a different period that we can, and a different region that we can study in the ongoing history of ancient India. So
Very interesting. Yeah, because the Vedic people, they were pastoral nomadic, and suddenly we saw cities sprouting up in eastern India. And what happened? Why did it happen?
why did
And
it happen?
it's very interesting. So the next session will be on early Buddhism and Jainism. I think this part is the like people look forward the most, because we as Chinese people, we are partially like relatively familiar with the Buddhist narrative of how Buddha became Buddha, basically. And how much historicity can we attribute to that narrative?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one that's hotly debated. Some scholars, although a minority, will deny that there was a historical Buddha at all. And I think it's important, if we were to pretend, even if we were to just pretend to that idea, we would need to speculate what Buddhist history would look like without a Buddha. What would be the beginnings of the tradition, and how would it develop such that a Buddha figure appears? Now, I think that even if you ascribe to a historical Buddha, those questions are of value. And it's interesting to speculate about the early history of how did ascetic sodalities come into being. There are lots of things that, because the Buddhist and Jain tradition is so long, and that we simply assume are features of ascetic existence. For instance, Jains are not supposed to have possessions. Buddhists are supposed to have limited possessions. Buddhists and Jains are supposed to live celibate lives in monasteries or isolated in forests, etc. And people sort of assume, well, if you're going to be an ascetic and seek the truth, that's just natural. But somebody came up with that for the first time. Someone came up with this idea that these things would be preferable. And the question is, was it an individual like the Buddha or Mahavira, or was there already an ascetic tradition in place in which Buddha and Mahavira came to be, that had these values already? And if so, why? And how did they develop? So, how did the, I guess what I would say is, how did the basic culture and practices of the renunciate tradition develop, such that Buddhism and Jainism was possible? And then also, what is the difference between this early period and what we see as the, and what we see anachronistically as narratives about that period? For instance, one of the most famous narratives about the Buddha's life is from the Buddhacharita. The Buddhacharita tells us the most complete version in many ways, and it's an epic poem about the life of the Buddha. And there are scraps of the story before this. For instance, we see in Gandharan texts evidence that already that Buddha has goes out 4 times, right, and sees the sick man, the old man, the dead man, and then the renunciate. But prior to the Gandharan materials, it's very scarce, and we don't really get a full Buddha narrative until Ashvaghosa. But Ashvaghosha is 2nd century CE. We could say that he's possibly on the cusp or one of the inspiring authors that would come to bring the classical period into being. So what is the narrative of the Buddha? Is it really something that helped shape the classical period? Or how old is it? And if so, what did people think about the Buddha before those narratives were sort of keyed into place? So hopefully something that we're going to be looking at is trying to separate out, like with a sieve, what we think of as genuinely early textual passages versus retroactive textual passages that are trying to tell us about that history, but which are themselves much later.
Very interesting. The Buddhist materials on Buddha, I mean, what we know about Buddha or what we supposedly know about Buddha are all from Buddhist materials. And most of the Buddhist materials about Buddha are from a relatively later date, say over 500 or 700 years after the death of Buddha. So, but it will be very hard for for us to see through and tell which is fictional, which is historical in these materials.
And part of the question too is, right, not just what can we tell, but what kind of tools and methods are actually realistic to use. People have tried to unearth the history of this period many times, and there's many disagreements. I mean, it's a very contentious thing. And to do that, people have developed all kinds of tools, like what particles get used in this Pali passage, meaning it's this age, versus what particles get used in this Pali passage, meaning it's from a different age. Are those reliably good tools, or could it be that we have just different eras of imitators? The right to write a good pop or write a good Pali passage. Do you use these particles because they're how you speak Pali, or because you're imitating a certain style that you saw in the text that you prefer? So it becomes very difficult to date them internally. Usually, what I'm going to give students at the end of a session will be a PDF for the next session to read over the course of that week. And usually I think what they're going to be reading is something like a general introduction to how this era or issue or problem came into our consciousness as scholars. For instance, the first thing you read about Indus Valley is not who were the Indus Valley people and what language did they speak, but rather, how were these sites discovered and what did early thinkers think about them, right? So to create an engaged method of understanding the past, I don't want to just give you the latest conclusions. I want to give you the history of scholarship on it so that you can see the kind of success, but also stumbling blocks that scholars have hit. And it's in your position to evaluate what you think is reasonable.
Very interesting. I think we don't have time to go through each session. I think we have reached our time limit. So I will talk about the logistics a little bit. So there will be 8 sessions every week on Sunday morning, Beijing time, from 9 to 11, right? No, no, not from 9 to 11. Yes, it is from 9 to 11, Beijing time in the morning. And actually, we start from next Sunday and consecutively for 8 weeks. And I think I will talk about this in Chinese later on. But
Okay.
we can open up for questions. If anybody has any questions, they are welcome to raise their hands in Zoom or just to raise it in the commentary. Any questions?
Maybe you're wondering what these masks behind me are. Those are my wife's. Couldn't tell you. I'll cover them up with my head so they don't disturb you.
It's okay.
Yeah.
So you moved to a new house, right? And
So I live in Macon, Georgia, which is about an hour away from Milledgeville, where I teach. And I'm currently teaching a summer school class that meets every day. So I get
Oh.
to, I'm listening to a lot of audiobooks.
Good. So how far is this house from the house that I visited you last time? The one in Savannah? This is far from Savannah?
It is about 2.5 hours drive from Savannah.
Oh, okay.
I
I
can
don't
only think of
think, yeah.
distances and amount of time.
We have one message. Yeah, there will be recordings for each session, of course. And I think you can even add captions live in Zoom, so it will be much easier. You can see. No, we don't need any Sanskrit background. It's for Muggles.
So I will, as far as materials before, I'm going to give you a PDF of something to read before the session. And then after, when the session is done, you'll have a recording of the session. And also I'll give you my PDF, or I'll give you whatever slide deck I provided. And the slide, the PowerPoint, you'll have that too after the session for review. And presumably, I think at the end of the PowerPoint, I'll have a list of additional sources for you to read if you want to read on your own, academic sources that will let you go into this topic in more detail.
That'd
But
be
I don't
great.
want to give you too much up front because there's an old aphorism to teach someone nothing, show them everything. So I want to give you a limited amount to get you ready for the session. And then after that session's over, I'll make forth with more materials. I hope that's acceptable.
Yeah, that's great. We do need an extended list of reading. Even though we don't read them, we will be happy to have them at hand.
Well, you know, as Bruce Lincoln said, the only difference between scholarship and mythology is the footnotes and the citations. So it's important to have the sources, even if you don't intend on reading them cover to cover, to know where from what are these lectures ultimately derived. It's they were not inspired purely by my dreams.
Okay. I think we're done. I think we're good. Yeah. People already had an inkling of what the course will be like. Just you talking
Hey.
about ideas. Interest, very interesting. Sometimes controversial ideas. For example, in China, we had a very Marxist explanation about the emergence of Buddhism as a form of like anti-oppression of Hinduism or Brahmanism. But that's a very, very, very superficial or easy explanation.
Well, you know, in 19th century Europe, there was a similar explanation, but not through Marxism. The idea was that Buddha arose as a rejection of Hindu ritual formalism, which was empty. But really, they were just projecting on Buddha their own ideas about Martin Luther, and they saw Buddhism as a kind of Protestantism rejecting Catholicism. So we always sort of imagine the past through the tools that we can imagine them through today. And I think that's fine. We should just be aware of that and be self-reflective. I think that humans are ultimately not as creative as they think they are, and our new ideas are always made up of our old ideas.
So basically, the same thing that happened to Zoroastrianism also happened to Buddhism.
Although with Zoroastrianism, we can point our finger, I think, at one person, Mary Boyce, and say it's her fault.
Don't say that. I don't think.
No.
I don't think it's fair.
Wow.
Anyway. So somebody asked if it's possible to just participate by watching the recordings. Of course, it is possible. We will provide recordings about 1 hour or 2 hours after each course so that you can check the recordings. And each session lasts about 1 hour and a half, maybe. And there will be 1 hour lecturing and half an hour Q&A to answer your questions. Answer
people's questions, any kind of question, I think.
And if you
Yeah.
think half an hour is long for Q&A, I will do my best to keep it at half an hour. But often, as you might have noticed, I spill over. I'm the kind of professor that lectures a little past the bell.
It's
And
yeah.
so I will do my best to keep my lecture to an hour and a half. But it's nice to have a good 30 minutes of Q&A just in case I do end up spilling over. We still have lots of good time to
Right.
field questions.
Yeah.
And sometimes I won't have the answers to those questions. That's the sad fact. I mean, is it the sad fact or the exciting fact? There are lots of questions you will ask me that I won't have good answers to, and that's good. But I will be able to direct you to sources that might have the answers. But there's still so much we don't know about this period of time.
Of course, to know what we don't know is also a kind of knowing.
That's right.
It reminds me again and again of what Shelver commented on my dissertation. Like, although I don't know what is right, I know you are wrong.
You know what he said? You know what he said during my prospectus defense? Have I told you this story?
No.
Where I was, he said, in your bibliography, you cite me as Octor Shervo, or as P. Octor Shervo. And I said, yes. And he said, I published that article under my full name of Prods Octor Shervo. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. And he goes, no, my boy, I'm not offended. It just makes me wonder if you've been this careless here. Where else have you made mistakes?
Oh,
Yeah.
I don't know why he's super harsh on you, and you. It's very strange, but anyway, we shouldn't talk about.
I think probably because I find it somewhat charming. I mean, I like that about him. I feel like his lack of filter is refreshing and honest, even if it sometimes seems cruel. And maybe he knows that about me, but I've always kind of liked that about Shervo. We all live in this, and because I'm not that way at all, I would never do that to a student, and I would never make someone feel uncomfortable. It's just not how I teach. So I guess because it's so well without outside of my own mode of thinking that I kind of treasure it. It's rich and alien to my own pedagogy. So yeah, I've always fond of Shervo.
Oh, nice. Maybe this is his former self, unfiltered self.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think that's for today. Thank you.
Okay.
So see
Well,
you
I'll see
guys.
everybody on
Yeah.
1 week from now.
Right.
But not at this time, right?
Right, not at this time. So it's Saturday night at your time and Sunday morning, China time.
Okay, Saturday night. Oh, the fun we'll have. All right. Well, you have the PDF for them for the first session. I've sent it to you.
Okay, yeah, sure.
So you can distribute that.
Okay.
Okay.
So thanks for coming, everyone. We will just end our event here.
I look forward to seeing y'all.
Bye bye.
Bye.